Hello again, everyone. All right, it's with pleasure now I get to introduce the panel discussion, which will be hosted by Jared. Joining Jared is Cheryl Murphy. Cheryl is the senior economist for ANZ Bank. Prior to joining ANZ, Cheryl worked at the Reserve Bank of Australia. At ANZ, her public sector economic impact analysis focuses on changes to government policies and budget. As senior economist for industry, economics and research, she provides macroeconomic analysis, on industry development. It's a bit tongue-tied this morning, sorry everyone. And joining Cheryl and Jared is Amy Oster. Amy commenced as the Deputy Secretary Economic in September 2016, this is with Victorian Treasury. Amy is responsible for the provision of high-level economic and policy advice to government on productivity, taxation and regulation, along with social, environmental and development issues. All please join me in welcoming back Jared, Cheryl and Amy. Thank you.
Well, thanks for that, Michael. We're going to have about 20 minutes of discussion here on stage and then open it up to the audience for Q&A. I think between Cheryl and Amy, we've got plenty of bases covered in terms of both the Commonwealth and state fiscal issues, so I think it'll be a great discussion. I do want to start a little bit on the Commonwealth budget, given it's just 2 weeks away, and I'm sure people are interested, particularly you, Cheryl, in what you have to say about that. There's been a lot of speculation about just where the fiscal position is at, how revenue is looking given what we've seen in the recent national accounts. How are you seeing the run-up to the budget in terms of the revenue impacts, the kind of fiscal room that there might be for the Commonwealth to do something that we don't expect in this budget?
Of course, the Treasury last put their forecasts out only in December, which doesn't seem like it was very long ago. But ever since then, of course, we've seen really quite dismal economic data, including on the GDP front. And consequently, we think, it seems very likely that the Treasury will revise down their numbers. So if I give you a point of comparison, we've got 2.2% growth in 2018-19 compared to Treasury's current 2.75 and 2.6% in 2019-20 compared to Treasury's 3%. So it seems quite likely that the real GDP numbers will definitely be revised down. So you would think on the surface that that means that the fiscal or the coffers might be suffering a little bit, but when you look at nominal GDP, which is really where what matters for the budget clearly, because they're pulling in real dollars, the forecasts actually look quite good. So what they put out in December looks pretty much spot on to us. There is probably also room for some upside surprises because of the stronger than expected commodity prices. Now that's obviously a big revenue generator for the government, a little bit of luck in there, probably more than anything in terms of how much is coming in. But when you look at how much that's actually worth, we make some estimates around that, and it looks like the increase in iron ore prices relative to what Treasury thought will bring in something around probably about $1.2 billion in this financial year, and then about $3.6 next financial year, so that's quite a big sum. Then you add in the upside on met coal, which has been much stronger again than Treasury expected. That in itself is worth about another $200 million in 2018-19 and another $1 billion next year. The Australian dollar is a teensy bit lower than the government expected as well, or they have a working assumption that it remains unchanged. It's actually depreciated about a cent since MAIFO. So again, you get a little bit more upside there. So when you add that to MAIFO's revenue decisions that revenue reductions, which they had sort of tucked away in the budget but not actually announced, which we read as tax cuts, you're getting about another $7 to $8 billion a year for the next few years in revenue. So that means probably definitely we're seeing some tax cuts, and probably we'll see bigger tax cuts than had been factored in MAIFO in December. How much are they worth? Well, we'd assume that the government won't spend all of extra revenue on personal income tax cuts. So we make an assumption of about half of the extra revenue coming through there. And what that does is adds about 0.2 to 0.3% to household income. So it's not huge. In fact, it only equates to a few dollars per week per person. But certainly it's larger than, or the fiscal room is larger than the government would have assumed even just a few months ago.
So certainly a very short-term view, things are not perhaps as bad as the headline figure suggests. But if we think about the broader environment and concerns about slowing global growth, economic uncertainty, what is it that you will be looking for in the Commonwealth budget and the reply in terms of, I guess, that longer-term preparedness?
As we kind of look to a world that's maybe not quite as buoyant, as you say, as it was even 12 months ago, it's good for the government to sort of use fiscal policy as a sort of, I guess, somewhat of a balancing tool. And I really think that the use of the personal income tax cuts are a very sensible way to do that. Personal income tax cuts, as you showed in your chart, are now sitting at about a 13-year high as a proportion of GDP. Now, of course, some of that's because we've got a strong labour market and we've got lots of people employed, but the other part of course, is bracket creep. And we are due to get some money back from the government, so just really returning back what inflation has eaten away. So I think that personal income tax cuts are quite sensible, actually, at the moment, because we have a household sector which is dealing with falling house prices right across the country now. And we also have consumer confidence taken a little bit of a hit recently. We've got low wages growth. What better really for the government to do right now than to sort of inject a little bit of surety back into the household sector with some personal income tax cuts? So I think that's actually very sensible. And it seems almost inevitable that we're going to get that. And we know that we'll get that whether we have a coalition government or a Labour government. They will both be doing that. In terms of what else the government can do, if we look at what the government shouldn't do, I mean, it wouldn't want the government to be giving back everything that it sort of has fallen into luck of receiving. So this increase in commodity prices, it would be nice if they held on to a little bit of that and did provide that buffer. Again, as you said in your presentation, it is good for the government to use these kind of fiscal windfalls to protect for a rainy day, and in case that really is another crisis, it's good to have that in the bag. So it would be good if they didn't give it all away, but I suspect they probably will, particularly if you're sitting in the coalition, you're not going to want to leave much sitting around for the other side on the off chance that they get into government. But I suspect that we will see that. And look, there's nothing wrong with buoying or lifting the economy through a bit of, good old-fashioned fiscal stimulus when things are a bit slow, particularly on the consumption side, as we said. I think that's perfectly reasonable policy. But of course, it's the quality of spending as much as the quantity of dollars that have been given away that matters. So, in theory, you could remove several billion dollars of bad spending and replace it with several billion dollars of good spending. And by good, I mean things that encourage innovation, that encourage people to work, that encourage people to save. If you could effectively do that, and replace it, and you could still have a budget surplus. So I don't necessarily think that we need to give away the surplus just to pump the economy a little bit. We could still have a pretty good outcome there either way. The other thing, of course, that the government could do is simply continue on its path to building further infrastructure or equity injections into infrastructure. That's been an incredibly important part of the economy in the last few years. Not only the state governments, obviously, but the Commonwealth government has been spending more than it had in the previous decade in the last few years. And again, I think there's room for that going forward. And in fact, the public sector has been a good source of strength, and it's really kind of buoyed the economy at a time when otherwise things have been quite soft because of the housing and mining downturn. So it's something else it could do.
Okay, so you're painting quite a positive picture for the upcoming budget, I think, Cheryl.
Yes.
Perhaps if we move to the state issues, and Amy, really interested, we often focus a lot on health when we talk about the state fiscal pressures, but clearly there's a lot of different service delivery and other demands that you're dealing with on a day-to-day basis. Just interested in what you see as some of the key drivers of increased expenditure and some of the kind of the service delivery demands and challenges that are keeping you awake at night.
Well, fortunately, so in my role in Treasury, I'm mainly responsible for the revenue side, tax policy, and also intergovernmental relations. So I don't have to keep awake at night on expenditure. I'm just there to figure out how to fund it. But there's, there's kind of an inherent balance in the Victorian state budget, which is quite nice in that to the extent that service demand is driven by population growth, which it has been very much in recent years, we tend to see an increased or, quite a positive revenue picture that's also associated with that. So we've tried to up the ante on our sensitivity analysis in our budget papers. And 2 years ago, we did some sensitivity analysis around population growth, labor force participation, and what that would mean for budget outcomes. And essentially what we found is is that labor force participation particularly really keeps revenue high enough to largely account for the expenditure pressures that come through from relatively high population growth. And I think that's what we're seeing. As much as there's quite a lot of commentary about what's happening in the property market and the impact on the state budget, and there was a write down between budget and budget update on stamp duty or land transfer duty, that was largely compensated for by an increase in GST, both the pool and our GST relativity, as well as payroll tax performs quite well. We've done some analysis on the correlation there. The correlation's actually very weak, as in that's positive for our revenue mix. So we've got a number of major revenue lines, and some are property related, but particularly payroll tax, which is not, tends to move in the opposite direction. So although we may have, we certainly see a lot of demand coming through the budget on the expenditure side for services and of course for infrastructure, and that's a very strong policy in this government. The revenue is sort of continues to match that, and that's the kind of the anticipated dynamic. Where we see a lot of that demand coming through, so it's interesting, I think, people talk a lot about population growth. Where we've looked at this is, and we really talk about it more in the context of demographic change. So there's the overall growth, but you have to dig a bit more beneath the surface to understand how that translates into expenditures and required expenditures. So what I mean by that is, even between Victoria and New South Wales, there's quite a difference. Victoria, about 60% of our population growth is due to overseas migration. We have a huge amount of interstate migration that we're benefiting from at the moment. Very different to New South Wales, which is about 80% international migration, so that already is the difference. The migrants who come to Victoria, whether interstate or overseas, tend to be quite young, 25 to 29 years old. 50% of them are married, 48% of them have children. It's a particular demographic, and so yes, there's health expenditure related to that, but there's also education expenditure. So we've got 90,000 more kids coming in to the education system in Victoria over the next 5 years that we've got to account for and have the schools for and have the workforce for. That's a big area of expenditure and pressure. And even aside from the numbers, there's kind of a spatial element that I find really interesting. So we've done a lot of work on where people settle, where they're going, and where they're not going. One thing that I think has sort of come up is also the cost of aging in certain parts of Victoria. So parts of regional Victoria are depopulating, and the population that's there is an aging population, which is quite an expensive population to service, and try to tell a community, for example, that they don't need their police station anymore, this can be a big issue. So when we talk about kind of cost pressures coming from changing demographics, there's a range of issues there. Certainly the bulk of it is in health and education, which is about 50% of our total expenditure, but there's different kind of pressures within that, And we're doing quite a lot of work to try to do some medium, sort of 10-year projections and see how some of these factors will play out.
Okay, and so you've touched there a little bit on some of the demographic differences across states. Shirella, be interested. You produce a state-ometer, I think you call it. Just be interested, particularly given we seem to be in an environment now where Victoria and New South Wales, very low rates of unemployment, whereas some of the other states not growing so quickly. Just interested in what your state-ometer is telling you about the growth of different states and how that's impacting on their budgets.
So, interestingly, the state-ometer, which I'm responsible for the name, I apologise, is a momentum indicator. So what actually is telling us is how a state is growing relative to its own past and its own trend rate. So interestingly, what that's been telling us for the last 6 months is that New South Wales and Victoria have been slowing. In fact, they've been growing at below trend and with reduced momentum. That doesn't mean to say they're going backwards. That just means that, you know, relative to what has been a very strong recent past, so when the housing boom was in full swing, they're slowing down. Now, that's, of course, because of the housing situation, and the state-ometer has quite a number of housing indicators in it, which probably slightly overbiased that sector relative to others. Having said that, in the December quarter state-ometer, which we just released a couple of weeks ago, we started to see some of that housing pressure flow into the other East Coast capital, the other East Coast states. And these are states which had been doing exceptionally well. Tasmania, we all know, has been the kind of outperformer, but even that was starting to show some signs of slowing down a little bit. ACT equally as well. On the other hand, you've got the so-called mining states, the Western Australia and Northern Territory in particular, which is still really showing the signs of the mining construction downturn. And Queensland, which is probably suffering a little bit of a housing downturn and mining downturn, so that's a bit of a difficult one. So it doesn't in any way alarm us. It just shows us that we're kind of returning to something that's perhaps a little bit closer to normal, given that what we've seen in the housing sectors and the stimulatory impact was never going to last. We know that. So what does it mean for the budgets? Well, I mean, clearly, as Amy's referred to, the fact that, you know, you will see some slowing down in stamp duty or transfer duty. But, of course, the state governments know that, and they factored that into their forecasts already. As you said, that you know, there was an adjustment put into between budget and last year. So actually, the state governments, as long as they've kind of got this in the numbers, it shouldn't actually affect their outlook or how they plan too much. So it's just a matter of being realistic, I think, on that front. Now, of course, it's very difficult to get that exactly right, and there's got to be some calibration. But, you know, the rest of the economy doing pretty well. Again, as Amy said, the payroll numbers looking pretty good. Employment growth is quite good. Even though we don't have strong wages growth, we certainly have strong employment growth. And there doesn't seem to be any sign of that slowing down. So I would say that, you know, yes, we have a slowdown. Is it a disaster? Absolutely not. You know, it's probably more of a realignment. If you're a policymaker looking at that sort of situation and sitting in a Commonwealth policy seat, what can you do about it? Well, I mean, if we start with the Reserve Bank, probably actually not very much. You know, there's a bit of an aside, but our view is that the Reserve Bank really can't do very much by lowering the cash rate to stimulate the economy again, because it's very much the supply of credit that's slowing things down, not the price of credit. There's probably things they can be doing behind the scenes, but on the surface, there's not much they can do with monetary policy to sort of to even out that slowdown. But certainly from a Commonwealth Treasury point of view, again, coming back to the tax cuts, that's an obvious way to sort of cushion the economy against this sort of housing slowdown, mining construction still having a big impact on Western Australia and the Northern Territory. So that's a couple of things they can do. Of course, putting, as is often the case with policymakers at the national level, it's really putting in place the best possible economic environment for the best possible growth and letting the economy do its own work. makes a lot of sense.
So I'm going to ask Amy one last question, and then we'll come to the floor. So please have your questions ready. Amy, I want to ask you, I spoke about the 2008 federal financial relations reforms and just my concern that those have unravelled. Can you see any opportunities within the current framework that we've got on federal financial relations to patch things up, or are we at a point that we have to address this vertical fiscal imbalance and states have to do some kind of tax reform? Is that achievable? Is there appetite? What do you make of my assessment here?
Well, when I read the report, I was really pleased to see on the last page of the executive summary, this headline, it said, remember the states and territories. It's very encouraging to see. And, you know, we talked about this in the lead up, and, you know, I wish I had some brilliant proposal to land on, you know, what we can do about Commonwealth state and fiscal federal relations. So, you know, for my sins, I attend all the CFFR meetings and now also the Board of Treasurer meetings. So people may or may not be aware, but the state and territory treasurers created a new entity about a year ago now, which is a state and territory only kind of shadow to the Commonwealth Fiscal Federal Relations process, where they get together and talk about common issues and try to solve some problems amongst themselves. In fact, that was sort of an outcome of a presentation that Peter Harris gave to CIFA, where he talked in the Productivity Commission's report about what states and territories can do to address productivity growth within their own domain. So that's been a big item on the agenda. But in terms of the funding relationship, it's a difficult one. So those national partnership agreements that you mentioned, and there are only a few of them. I think there's always going to be a natural kind of tension in those negotiations. A couple of them now have gone into legislation, which is kind of a whole new ball of wax, and we'll have to see how that plays out. It's not clear to me, you know, if one party or the other doesn't live up to the agreement and the agreement's in legislation, what does that sort of mean down the track? And those other, you know, the proliferation of small agreements, I think, in a sense, you know, the Commonwealth, there's areas of public policy, service delivery that the Commonwealth will be interested in where essentially they don't hold the levers. And so there will always be interest from Commonwealth ministers in figuring out, you know, if they're trying to have a policy influence in a local community, really through the state is the only way they can do it. So I think that, you know, those partnerships or agreements or whatever you want to call them, are they're going to be a reality. And the fact that there may be, you know, more than 50 of them, it is what it is. I think for me the bigger issue is, and it goes to tax and your question about vertical fiscal imbalance, as well as regulation and policy levers, is to think about where those levers sit and how we really want to affect change. So, for example, and we talk a lot about revenue and what revenue we're getting and looking at taxes and tax cuts and where we think current tax mix should be and what the rate should be. But we don't tend to look as much as, you know, for example, what we're not taxing. Which is a particular bugbear for me. You know, giving an example of the digital economy and how our traditional tax base is eroded, this is a real gap in Commonwealth-state relations because states have no lever in that space anymore, you know, whatsoever. We're very circumscribed in terms of what we can tax under the Constitution. And the Commonwealth doesn't, I think, probably necessarily have all that much incentive to look into some of those areas. So we miss them totally in tax and in regulation in many respects. And so we're missing out on those levers to help drive innovation and productivity. And we kind of keep going back to the same conversation on, you know, GST, GST allocation, how are we going to manage health costs? But we're not looking at those bigger levers that we could pull on. In the health space, another one, an obvious one, and you raised mental health, would be how are we looking at funding from outside of government. So what are the policy levers that we could be pulling on to increase the ability of people to self-fund their mental health care? Similar to NDIS, you know, where, how can we take more of an insurance-based, and I mean preventative, approach to healthcare rather than leaving the majority of our focus at the acute end of the system? These are the conversations that don't tend to happen because we kind of get into the weeds of who's going to fund what on what we've already got. And I'd hope that, you know, down the track we can kind of lift our gaze into sort of, as the PC report outlined, you know, what are some of the big differences that we could make, but also how do we develop the policy levers to make that change? Because I think we're not doing it as much at the moment.
All right, well, we might open it up. We've got some roving mics at the back. The usual rules apply. If you can state your name and organisation before you ask your question, that would be wonderful. We've got one here.
Hi, Neil Saxton from Hester Superfunded. A question for the panel, and Amy briefly touched on this, but also for you, Jared. In your presentation, you talked about broadening the tax base, but there wasn't really much talk about the GST. I don't know, in particular, both major parties seem to have shied away from GST sort of increases or broadening the where the GST would be paid or received. But you briefly touched on that as well, Amy, in regards to the states thinking about how the money's distributed. So I just wondered if that is one way of the next step of tax reform, should obviously either state or federal governments be keen to look at that.
I'm happy to say that. I would say, well, yes, should. So we've done, and you know, I'm sure that many of you will already be aware, but for those who aren't, we published this publication. It's on the DTF website called Victoria's Economic Bulletin. We've put out two volumes. So that's four research pieces that come out twice a year. One that we published last year was looking at the GST as a revenue base and effectively how it's not keeping up with what it's meant to fund for two reasons. One is that the base is eroding relative to economic activity. So we're not taxing as much of our economic activity, and I think that speaks to what's happening in the digital economy. And the second is because kind of the rate of inflation and what makes up most of the GST is lower than the services, than the rate of inflation and services that it funds, which is a real gap for states and territories because GST is a quarter of our revenue, so it's kind of a big issue. So, you know, broadening the GST base, I think, absolutely, but looking at when we think about goods and services, it does need to be kind of a comprehensive view of the economy. I think we really need to think a bit more about how we apply that in the digital economy. And again, that's not something that, you know, we can do at the sub-sovereign level. It's really up to the Commonwealth.
I think certainly, I mean, Amy's right. It was in the recent PBO analysis just how much the base has eroded. The IMF raised this in their recent report around the volatility of the tax base as well. I think the big challenge is how do you come into this debate and conversation without it immediately being ruled out or shut down. I think that's where the challenge is. How can we have a constructive tax debate where everything is on the table, at least in the first instance?
If I can just add, I think that I agree. It's almost a no-brainer that really needs to be, the base needs to be broadened. It's got to be done, I guess, in a most sensitive way. In other words, the low-income earners who are going to suffer just need to be compensated in the beginning. But also, I think, you know, we can be pretty tough on politicians here, but I think we, you know, as the voters have to accept, I don't know how you do that, but we have to accept that this has to change, really, going down the track. So, kind of sensible debate around the topic is very much needed.
Faya Kanduani from Newgate Communications. Amy, can I get you to imagine for a sec that you are a federal bureaucrat and you had an opportunity to tax the digital economy? What kind of thoughts has come to you?
Well, fortunately, I don't have to be too imaginative. Actually, Ricky Polygenis is here from Commonwealth Treasury. And I was just thinking about, I have to do a shout out to Saul Eslake, because all three of us, the three women at table two, were all hired by Saul into ANZ, you know, many moons ago. So we've known each other for a long time. I think the Henry Review gave us a lot of good ideas in that, you know, in that direction. So GST would be one. And so in terms of a broad application, you know, we don't tax hospitality platforms, so accommodation platforms, Airbnb, et cetera. So if you're a hotel, you pay GST. If you're staying in a hotel, there's GST. If you're staying in an Airbnb apartment, there's no GST. So those sorts of activities, like platforms, are kind of a big area to look at. The second one is, I guess, how we think about, and back to Jared's comment on corporate income tax, because we tax by jurisdiction and where companies are based, the Henry Tax Review essentially advocated for a business activity tax. And I think, you know, in this day and age, that is really worth considering, and that would probably be my first or most first kind of cab off the rank in terms of what could make sense, because you know, as economists, we like to talk about something that's, you know, efficient and productivity enhancing and reduce our deadweight loss. Another way to put that is to just look at what's sustainable, you know, what is the sustainability of the revenue base. And the narrower it gets, the less sustainable it is. It's more volatile, and it also means it's kind of less equitable. You just have, you know, fewer and fewer people who are liable for that tax. So you introduce an element of risk when you get to that situation. So I think figuring out a way to broaden that corporate income tax base would probably be my first preference.
Question down here.
Hi, I'm Connie Lenneberg from the Brotherhood of St. Lawrence. And I've got a question about the social compact. So we know that 1 in 8 Australians live in poverty, and that 40% of children in single-parent households live in poverty. It's been quite a debate about the need to increase Newstart, but we've seen 25 years of stagnation of Newstart. And when we think about a social compact, increasingly organisations like ours are hearing that we cannot afford to raise Newstart. We talk about mental health issues, other ancillary issues that come from people living in desperate poverty. We've got economists saying that there would be economic stimulus from increasing Newstart and the benefits that would have in terms of increased consumption. In thinking about the budget going forward, we're not, despite, you know, the Business Council of Australia, lots of economists saying this would be a positive move, we're not seeing any political will to actually change that. Do you see that our current economic model is predicated on a large number of people who are left behind, and that's the cost we have to bear for the kind of economic growth that we have? Thank you.
So I certainly don't think that is a cost that we should bear or that we should tolerate. And certainly CEDA, like your organisation and others, has been very strongly supporting an increase to Newstart. We will continue to do that. I've been in many conversations where really people are scratching their heads about why neither side of politics has taken this up. It does seem like a very sensible, compelling investment would be the way that I would put it. So I think there's absolutely an issue there. I think there's a broader issue also around how we look at big government programs in future, and the Productivity Commission's inequality report touched on this, just the need to have more tailored services and solutions for people in disadvantage, and more bringing together different levels of government, different services, and tailoring them better to address entrenched disadvantage and poverty. So I absolutely think it has to be top of the agenda. You can't have, you know, economic growth and prosperity without addressing this issue. And certainly we'll continue to put it at the top of our list in terms of things that need to be addressed urgently by the government.
If I can just add, Connie, I agree entirely, and I sort of think that Prime Minister Ardern in New Zealand has done some great stuff around this in terms of talking about, yes, we have GDP, which is growing at a reasonable rate, and we have a low unemployment rate, but we as a government want to consider other measures, well-being indicators, infant mortality, health indicators, etc., and that's how we'll judge ourselves. And so I think there's some lessons for us as a nation to take from that. Yeah.
Question here.
Hi, Tanya Smith from NAUS Group. So the impression, and I really appreciate all the commentary and the insights that have come through this morning, but my overall impression is that message is, oh, you know, we're continuing to muddle through, okay, we make kind of incremental adjustments and we work through the cycles and we kind of get there in the end. And I'm just trying to envisage what the big potential shocks or risks might be to the economy. If you project ahead 10 years, and I'm thinking about, you know, climate change, I'm thinking about potential major structural adjustment to the labour market with unemployment really starting to sink into services and the professions and that sort of thing. I'm thinking about the unevenness of growth and what that means for different communities and how governments need to respond to that in much more costly and proactive ways perhaps than they have in the past. What are the perhaps one from each of you? What is the biggest risk that you see in terms of not just budget balances 10 years hence, but to our overall economic growth, productivity, and competitiveness?
Ah,
anyone going to start?
challenges to overall growth, productivity, and competitiveness. I'd probably name a few. I mean, one observation I would say is that there is a significant adjustment underway, and we talk about what's happening in the property market, but what's really happening is that between the Commonwealth government and the RBA, over time, there needs to be essentially the engineering of a household deleveraging, and that is a big challenge. And nobody should underestimate that, you know. So, you know, does the RBA have room to move? You know, they could, but is stimulating a new round of credit growth into the household sector, you know, is that a policy objective? Like, you know, probably not. So that in and of itself, is a significant challenge. And, Australia didn't really experience the GFC the way the rest of the world did. And it's 10 years later, but we can't underestimate how significant a shock that was and how long that takes to wind through the system. And I think we are still adjusting to that economically and politically. So, you know, that to me is ongoing. In terms of productivity and competitiveness, two things really come to mind. You mentioned climate change. I agree with that. The kind of related issue is the transition of our energy system and our energy market as we increase renewables in one sense, but kind of more importantly, what's going to happen with our baseline energy as we retire very big assets, generation assets that are coming close to their end of life. And what does that mean for our transmission and distribution grid, which is set up for a past that is not going to look the same in the future? It's a big transition and one that requires a lot of pretty careful policy management. So I kind of put that one up in lights. And the third one that I mentioned is very much kind of on the mind, you know, working at the state level, is productivity in the services sector, in health and education, because a lot of that does sit in government. So how do we work across the public sector, the private sector, and community sector to ensure that we can deliver those services well and to the broad community and still continue to grow productivity as we have in the past?
I might just highlight the trade issue, because I think that what's happening globally, in terms of, you know, we've made so much progress on trade, and clearly now we're not. in fact, perhaps going backwards in terms of breaking down trade barriers. I think that is something that over the next 10 years in particular, we might start to feel the impact of, particularly if we continue to see this path unchanged. So that is scary to me. I think that's, you know, we had made so much progress on that front, and now we're going backwards there. So I think that anything we can be doing, and it is difficult sitting here as a small open economy, but anything that we can be doing to promote the continuing globalization and you know, obviously sustainable and to some extent shared globalization or shared benefits of globalization is very important. You know, as we've talked, or as Amy's mentioned, the productivity story is incredibly important in that realm. You know, trade barriers can be a real impediment to growing productivity, particularly if they're kind of, you know, we're seeing kind of barriers at that trade front. It can be very damaging for our own growth. And we really, particularly as a strong growing services economy, we have to be at the frontier as much as we can to continue to grow and to continue to compete, and therefore to pay people good wages, which will lift their household income and you know, allow more of us to enjoy a higher quality of life. So I think trade's going to be a big one going forward.
I'd say complacency. I think that's the biggest challenge. I think we need to radically change how we deliver policy and programs, and I think we're seeing continual kind of manifestations of some of the issues. If you look at energy, areas like entrenched disadvantage, where we have not made the progress that we should have, and we need to fundamentally change how we make policy in terms of reaching across different sectors, looking outside administered government programs and other forms to actually get to solutions. And certainly that's something that we're focused on in CEDA's research agenda, and something that we'll be working on through the remainder of the year. So that'd be mine. Any other questions? One more. Oh, we've got two.
Really enjoying the session this morning. Marianne Di Gelinato, Director of Corporate Services at Maroondah City Council, and I was so pleased to hear that we've talked about mental health, we've talked about energy. These are the sort of the two main issues, I guess, that most local communities are kind of grappling with. And we can throw gambling in there, we can throw family violence in there as well. My question is really one more of the waste game, and it's a lead on really from the previous question. In terms of the importance of waste, recyclables, the potential collapse of market, it's such a thin market, there's very few players in it, the need for federal, state and local governments to be working together, as well as the private sector kicking in from a venture capital perspective to get some sustainability going. It's probably more, Amy, for yourself, given that you're looking at the Victorian lie of the land and, you know, what's working and what's potentially about to fall off the cliff. Just any sort of considerations that you guys do about the waste market and what that might look like in the next 5-10 years?
Yeah, thanks for the question. Sorry, it's obviously very tricky. That was a shock, believe it or not. So, you know, once again, the impact of a policy decision by China that does come as a shock to our market. So just emphasizes again the importance of this very large trading partner to our north. This has been a subject of a lot of discussion at the Board of Treasurers, and an effort by states and territories to collaborate and look at what we can do individually and collectively. Victoria is in a bit of a more stressed position around this than other jurisdictions. Mainly because I think of the way that the contracting has been managed in the past. So fortunately, that's something that is actually something we can work through, and it will take a bit of time. But if we can work on aggregating up some of those contracts that councils hold, we should be able to increase our bargaining power and get some better shape to the market and more options for councils and for consumers to look through and get that recyclables market operating more efficiently. It really is kind of a market design issue that we have to work through first. And then, you know, ultimately in terms of the shape of the industry, the question is, what do we do with the stuff? And that's an innovation and investment question that it's a little bit of, it's not something I directly work with on at the moment, but it's definitely going to be a national conversation, I think, because, you know, we can't just keep stockpiling to infinity. We've got to figure out what we're going to do with it.
Thank you. We're quickly coming to time, so Michael's going to come back to the stage, but if you could join me in thanking Sherelle and Amy for today's discussion.